I think obviously starting that guilt selection probably prior than what you think is ideal is probably best, right? So obviously there's lots of things we can control from an eligibility standpoint, from age of puberty, weight at breeding, number of heat and no services, but really trying to be, I think, be critical on what type of guilts we even consider for eligibility. So where does that selection start? How early does it start? You know, when we start stimulating those guilts, obviously you can read confirmation structure earlier in life. So I think there's lots of things that producers can consider when we're looking at that 100 to 150 day window, as far as what type of guilt do I want to even consider for eligibility? And then from that 150, 160 days on, how do we develop those guilts just from a puberty stimulation standpoint, and maybe set those ones up that we deem to be selects at that point? How can we best set them up to be the next reproductive engine of our sow farm?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. SUNY, we provide value-added. Meta Farms, transforming agriculture with data-driven solutions for pork producers.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can improve your pig's vitamin D status. Hi-D offers pure, proven performance to help your pigs thrive.
Hi, welcome to our latest edition of SwineNet Podcast. I'm Jerry Purvis, your host. Today we have a special guest, Matt Romoser. Matt, welcome to our podcast today.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Always enjoy listening to some of the content put out here and look forward to being a contributor.
Very good. And Matt is currently a swine field specialist with the Iowa Pork Center industry. I'll let him tell a little bit about that. But so go ahead and maybe first let's dive in and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so appreciate the intro there. Matt Romoser, swine field specialist for the Iowa Pork Industry Center. We're sort of the extension arm, I guess, for the state of Iowa from a swine production side of things. So I myself, as well as a few other colleagues, service sets of counties across the state, as well as collaborate and work with a lot of the professors and researchers on campus at Iowa State as well. So, yeah, always sort of been a part of the pork industry since kind of growing up through it, and something deeply passionate about, especially what we'll discuss here today from the sow and guilt side of things. So,
yeah, very interesting. And so, Matt, maybe tell us a little bit about. So, you're actually a producer, an owner producer of a swine to finish operation.
So, grew up on a small farrow to finish operation. Still kind of help a little bit alongside it with my dad a little bit, but obviously as industries continue to integrate and challenges and so forth, obviously have pursued a career and an avenue, I guess, to be able to help producers across all facets of production and be involved in production as well at the same time. So.
SUNY is a professional solution provider for enzymes, probiotics, and functional additives. We offer customized formulas to target nutritional issues in livestock and maximize the utility of animal feed. Find us at SUNY.com, spelled S-U-N-H-Y, for more information.
Yeah, very good. You know, appreciate, I know you, as you get into learning and finding new things, I guess it's always interesting how you can kind of parlay back to your own family's business as well. So new things you learn, it's always interesting as you see and go ahead and apply that. If you found that to be true, kind of fuels your passion, maybe, so to speak.
Oh, I would say so. Yeah, I mean, certainly, at least based on past experiences. Just obviously being able to grow up around it, you kind of figure out what you're really passionate about. And for me, it was always sort of on the breeding and the genetics side of things. And as I kind of reflect back on a lot of my experiences from the first time what I really learned what artificial insemination was, and clear on into, you know, doing my graduate work at Iowa State then, it's just something that I've always been pretty interested in and pretty passionate about, as far as how can we do as far as optimizing productivity on farms and ultimately helping producers, you know, be profitable and be sustainable, I guess, if you will. So, yeah, it's something that when I really reflect back on my professional career, it's just, I don't know if it's ever really strayed away from it. I've always just been pretty passionate about reproduction, breeding, genetics side of things, and continues to today.
what are some of the things that we should be looking for in selection of animals?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit on a good point there as far as the gilts and the gilt pool is really the reproductive engine, or is going to be the engine of that sow farm as far as what its future productivity going to be. So ultimately, the individuals we select to bring to our herd are going to determine the success of that farm for maybe the next 12 to 18 months, right? So I think when you think about selection industry-wide, I think that a lot of times producers are generally on the same page and understanding of what it is, but I think there's a lot that really goes into it that maybe gets overlooked or we don't pay as much attention to. I think you hear conversations around gilt eligibility, and I think there's lots of good value to be had when I think some of these producers or genetic companies even provide, you know, what's a good targets for gilt eligibility as far as weight when she's bred, age of when she's bred, and so forth. I think that helps producers, figure out how to manage that gilt, but this doesn't necessarily, I would say, determine whether that animal is a good candidate to be bred. Just for example, so if you have an ideal candidate that maybe has had a heat nose service and she's standing at 30 weeks of age and she's 330 pounds or whatever, by a lot of the metrics, we would say that's an ideal gilt from an eligibility standpoint. But if she's poor structured and has a poor underline, she's still probably not a good candidate to be able to enter into the farm, right? So there's some different components you have to think about from an eligibility, but a selection standpoint as well, to be able to make sure that we're finding those ideal animals. And I think sometimes it's confounded a lot when we've got producers that are maybe strained to be able to have enough gilts to meet breed target. And so then it becomes a little bit of a situation where, well, she's got four legs under her and she's in standing heat, so we're going to go ahead and breed her so we can meet breed target, which obviously it's important to be able to do that just from the economics of the farm. But it's if they're not good candidates, you're potentially jeopardizing, what the future of that farm looks like, or that individual may just fall out after parity one and may never see see profitability, I guess, if you will. So obviously there's lots of challenges from a selection and eligibility standpoint, and it's all subjective, at least at this point, with the resources we got. So it's a challenge from farm to farm and from producer to producer.
Yeah, very good points, Matt. I call it gate selection. Sometimes we just luckily we want to have enough gilts just to meet, our breeding targets. But in those cases, let's go back maybe, how early, the earlier we can, maybe select some of these animals, the better off we are, maybe going back to our crossing farms. Are there some things that we can see even at like birth weight, or there's some metrics that, that producers can use to do, early selection, even before?
Yeah, there's some great work that's been done. And I think it's one of those things like it just all things take time from an adoption standpoint. And there's, the more and more data that this industry continues to collect with our, with a lot more electronics and everything being involved, we can collect a ton of data. And you mentioned, how far back can we go? I think you're exactly right, where we talk about what's that pre-weaning environment for that gilt. And how well can we set her up from the beginning? Now, there's been lots of work shown from Billy Flowers just on the impact that pre-weaning growth rate can have just on what's that reproductive development at say 20 days of age at weaning. What's the differences in reproductive tract development as far as looking at it from a cellular structure standpoint? I know there's been some work done, Jeff Vallée at US Mark and so forth, that looked at what's just the impact of colostrum on within the first 24 hours and how well does that set those gilts up. So I think when we talk about that pre-weaning environment, there's lots of things we can do from a split suckling standpoint, making sure that we're getting gilts that would be potential replacements, or at least replacement candidates, given if they're out of depending on the female they'd be out of. If we can split suckle those gilts, certainly in the first couple, 24 hours, to make sure they're getting adequate colostrum. I mentioned some of Billy's work where he's looked at just litter size, pre-weaning litter size, and how that affects. And in general, gilts from a smaller litter tend to do better from a weaning standpoint and then reach puberty earlier. Now, obviously, from a multiplication standpoint, we're always tasked because we want to have as, you know, as many gilts available to select. So having short letter sizes is counterintuitive. But obviously it lends itself, you know, to the notion that pre-winning environment is pretty impactful. And then just from the standpoint of, you mentioned birth weights, I think there's lots of data that would suggest, especially when you get to those lighter birth weight gilts, that their likelihood of ever reaching puberty or ever making the herd is minimal anyway. So if there's a way to identify those animals, you know, right away or early on as non-selects, all things important there, especially when we're just talking about, you know, what's the impact of if we keep them around in a GDU and then they end up hanging around until they're 33, 34 weeks of age and they never cycle. Suddenly that's a pretty costly replacement that we maybe could have sold and culled at an earlier market weight and maybe captured a little bit more premium that way.
So, you know, so you mentioned a lot of good things we can do as far as to impact growth. So we should maybe even start at that, you know, at those crossing farms and maybe increase in space, making sure those, as you said, those gilts are getting adequate colostrum. So you think that's an area maybe we start, is just making sure we're doing just a kind of the day one pig care. It sounds like just making sure that's getting checked.
Certainly. Yeah. Especially, you know, when, if you're a farm that's got, you know, you go on some farms, they've got some internal multiplication or what have you, or they've got a surplus of gilts or whatever to work with. I think for sure, if you've got the opportunity to be able to, manage some of those, at least in the first 24, 40 hours, try to get those gilts, especially off to a very good start. I think that's, you know, how impactful it is, you know, downstream. I think it's going to vary from farm to farm. But, you know, here again, especially if labor's no constraint, you know, control the controllables and try to do yourself as much of a service and trying to set those gilts up from day one. Right. And obviously there's lots of things that can transpire from down the way, whether it's disease and so forth that can obviously hinder a gilt's development. But, you know, obviously we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make those gilts, get those gilts off to a strong start.
Very good. So it sounds like, man, a lot of those things are under our control. You know, we actually can control some of that. Do you think there's some things that, you know, that gilt is predisposed? You know, some of our higher prolific gilts have characteristics that maybe it was intrauterine, something, you know, that happened there. Is that something you think there is some control, but there's also some predisposed conditions? Maybe talk a little bit about.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think when we talk, especially when we talk about just light birth weight pigs, right? So, like, I know there's been lots of work from Jenny Patterson and her group up in Canada, where we've looked at light birth weight phenotypes. But even as you mentioned, you know, we've got sows and these hyper prolific animals that are producing, you know, litters far exceeding what we saw maybe 5 to 10 years ago. And I don't know that we've in lockstep selected for uterine capacity simultaneously. So we've selected for lighter birth weight animals in general. So whether that impacts them from a future productivity standpoint, I think there's, you know, is to be seen. There's probably some variation farm to farm, but inevitably we probably are increasing those number of gilts that are below a certain weight threshold that we would determine non-selects to begin with anyway. So I think there's certainly some environmental conditions that those gilts are absolutely predisposed to that, you know, we could be capping ourselves from the start. So further highlighting what the discussion we would have had just a moment ago as far as getting them off to a good start as well.
Going into, let's just say they're going into a GDU, what are some things there you think producers maybe miss a little bit? Or, you know, we're always, I know at our end, sometimes your GDUs, those are people that maybe were contract growers or, you know, before and were growing commercial animals. So there's a little bit of a, you know, rewiring, I call it. What are some of the things maybe that we're missing, you know, as we try to raise these gilts?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you bring up a good point. You know, I've heard the phrase uttered a lot that we need to treat our gilts different than market hogs, which is, you know, obviously there's still 95% of the production is going to be identical as far as what we need to do from a, you know, obviously from a environmental standpoint, managing, you know, temperatures and water and so forth. Nutritionally, it's going to be different. You know, we're going to optimize maybe growth rate a little bit more and or control growth rate a little bit more from a dietary standpoint and implement probably a different CalFOS ratio within those gilt diets. So there's going to be some fundamental differences we're going to look at in GDU versus just, you know, grow to finish or wean to market type scenarios. You know, one thing that a study that I was involved with a number of years ago, actually was my graduate work, where we looked at doing a vulva score assessment, and it's sort of that middle growth, middle of the feeding period or middle of the growing period. So it's right around 15 weeks old, a little over 100 days of age. We looked at it and we did vulva width measurements. I think I was on probably about 1,000 gilts. I just wanted to see what was the impact of that early reproductive tract development and how did it set the, you know, could it be a potential selector criteria, or how did it predict future productivity, right? Because we know that, as early as 80 days old, some of those gilts can start to have a little bit of ovarian activity. So if we figure that that ovary is starting to produce low levels of estrogen, maybe that vulva is responding to a little bit of it. Now, we're talking scoring these vulvas 3 months ahead of when we probably intend to breed them, right? So way early in the selection window. But what we found was basically that bottom 20% of gilts, not only fewer of them reached parity one, but over of the ones that did reach parity one, we had, I think it was roughly about 2 to 2.5 pigs fewer in their parity one and parity two farrowing. So not only did a fewer of them actually reach parity one, but over their, you know, lifetime or through parity two production, they had fewer pigs. So, you know, I think just in that middle of that growing phase, I think there's some opportunity just to be able to identify ones that, you know, I don't even want to, if they're a little bit straighter shoulder, if they're a little bit lighter weight and they got a small vulva, I don't even want to waste my time considering them as potential gilt candidates, you know? So I think there's some things, you know, versus just monitoring ventilation and keeping feeders full and keeping waters running, there's some things that we can do from a selector standpoint early in that, while they're developing or while they're going through that GDU that we could look into for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, it seems there's a lot of opportunities for metrics that we can figure out. You know, you mentioned vulva size, but also what are some other things? As those gilts grow, obviously you're looking at structure, but what are some of the things you start to pan out? You know, as that group of gilts grow, and obviously age at puberty, is that something? Another area.
Certainly. I mean, the age at puberty is one that I think is probably our most accurate selector as far as that gilt's ability to reach parity three. And it's one that I think is often recorded on farms maybe, but maybe not always retrospectively looked back at as far as, you know, when we look at, okay, what was our fallout rate over the last 12 months? And then we look at, of the ones that fell out, when was their first documented H&S, you know, or how good did we do at H&S, and did we find those gilts truly on their first heat? You know, age at puberty, I think it's been replicated in several different studies, but it is, you know, the most indicative trait that we know currently as far as their ability to be able to reach parity three. And I think a lot of that stems back to those gilts, if they cycled earlier, you know, This would all be, I don't know that this has been necessarily studied, but as they cycle earlier, chances are they've probably got a little bit more active or a more sensitive reproductive tract. So when we think about those gilts going into lactation and then having to obviously go through a full lactation, then come back and rebreed, you know, within 5 days of what we might, you know, what we ask them to do, you know, maybe it's those gilts are wired a little bit different to where they're a little bit more sensitive from a reproductive tract standpoint, and that reproductive system and the endocrine system gets those gilts started sooner or they're quicker to respond once they're weaned and get back into production. Because obviously a lot of that fallout rate obviously is going to happen from P1 to P2 as far as what they're going to do from a return standpoint, or what the how they did based on maybe a previous farrowing and so forth. So I think age of puberty is certainly one that I think it gets documented, but I think it's a tool or a selection criteria that can certainly be used retrospectively a lot more on farms, at least from my viewpoint. I think so.
We have a time and labor saving product for you. AgriSlats by Healthy Farms is your solution. No more lugging jugs around the barn every month. With AgriSlats, you simply drop the slat through the floor twice a year, and it works to break down solids, reduces crusting and forming. To learn more, visit myhealthyfarms.com.
I want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Anatox. Research shows that feed sanitizers reduce the onset of viruses in commercial swine feed. Improve swine productivity through powerful pathogen control with Anatox today. Trow Nutrition North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Vaccinova. Formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines. Visit us at vaxinova.us.com for more info. That's vaxxinova.us.com. AccuFast. The best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. AB Vista. New nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production.
Yeah, I think, and that's the struggle we as producers is getting those, we want to get at least three parities out of every animal. And that's where I think our opportunity today is we're just, as an industry, we're really failing in that to really get that gilt paid for, per se. But it's really tough. And so you mentioned age of puberty. That's a metric that we should use. What do you think some of the, you always, and I know enough about reproduction to be dangerous, but I always hear more exposure. Is that something I know? How big of an impact does that have, and how early should that more exposure begin?
Yeah, it's hugely impactful, and it's one of those that how it's executed is maybe just as important as the boards that you're using to do it with, right? So there's lots of different research that's done or looking at fence line versus direct bore contact. I think almost all studies would conclude that direct bore contact is better, but it's not always feasible on GDUs just based on how we've constructed them, right? A lot of times those bores maybe have a designated area into the barn, and we take those bores to the gilts and expose them, in the alleyway, and we allow the gilts to be able to spend time along the fence line. I've been on some farms where they'll take the time and they'll just move bores from pen to pen and actually get them that direct contact. Obviously, that's a great option to do it, but it's challenging from a labor standpoint because it certainly takes more time just from a handling standpoint and a safety standpoint, right? If you actually have a high libido aggressive boar, then there's always, you have to be careful from an employee standpoint. And obviously, if somebody's not spent much time around pigs, maybe not as obviously as good as be able to read natural behaviors of a boar, but and in general, as far as time into when we do it, around 150, 160 days, I think is going to be a really optimal time to be able to get those gilts starting to be exposed, right? So when we get those gilts, obviously just getting them stimulated and getting them familiar with the boar is going to be obviously critical, but also having boars effective force stimulation is obviously going to be impactful too, right? We don't want to have, 3-year-old boars that maybe have low libido or maybe more interested in a few crumbs of feed on the ground as opposed to the gilts in the pen. So just making sure that obviously we've got high libido boars that are ready to do their job. And I think that's ultimately can be hugely impactful as far as setting those gilts up for success with regards to that. So,
that's a good point. I think a lot of people don't think about, we get boars and they get older, maybe their libido or whatever, they get too heavy, and that may be just as big and important as the time that's spent, exposing those gilts, for sure.
And I think it needs to be looked at from a couple different ways as far as, there's heat checking and running a board, you know, past a group of weaned sows, and typically you can get a fairly quick response. Obviously, if a sow's coming into heat, you can get a good response by running a board. But then when we're talking in the GDU, we're trying to stimulate those gilts who have never cycled before in their life. We're trying to bring them into puberty. So I think the approach from a heat check or a heat detection standpoint to a puberty stimulation standpoint needs to be taken a little bit differently. And you really need to probably target, you know, a good estimate, I would say, is 30 seconds per gilt. So if you've got, 25, 30 gilts in a pen, you're looking at needing to spend, you know, pretty significant amount of time per pen just to be able to get those gilts adequate time around the boar and just be able to get them stimulated versus, you know, obviously if you're in the breeding row or what have you, you're probably only spending a few seconds per sow actually to be able to detect heat. The rest of your time is spent, you know, inseminating or breeding them, right?
Yeah. You know, you made a good point. I think as you go out in the field, do you think this is an area where we're missing a boat? I know going out, it seems like, you know, you got guys doing a good job with feed and water and environment ventilation. But do you think this is an area where it seems that we kind of fall short sometimes? We don't make the, you know, investment in this area.
Oh, I think so. And I think it's a challenge with industry right now, just from a labor standpoint, right? You know, it becomes difficult, especially when you get on farms. You know, running a boar through the GDU sometimes can be not only it's time consuming, but it kind of gets viewed as a low value task. At times, you know, when you've got other things going on a farm as far as processing litters, breeding sows, day one pig care, you know, farrowing sows or assisting sows, you know, there's a lot of things that need employees' attention. And a lot of times it gets pushed to the back burner as far as being able to actually effectively expose gilts to a boar and be able to identify those H&Ss and get them, you know, get a documented heat no serve and get all that data recorded and then do something with it, right? Or getting, you know, periodically weighing gilts to get an idea of where they're at in their growth period to get an idea, make sure we're going to breed them at an ideal weight. So I think it's certainly a challenge, and it's one of those things that needs to be addressed because, as we've already highlighted, they're the next generation for that farm. So it just becomes it's a mindset or a mentality shift, if you will. As far as how high value of a task that becomes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think that's a good point. You know, sometimes the task that our employees value is not necessarily on the scale as high as the task that we value. You know, they may be worrying about some things, getting those done and skipping maybe the most important task that we consider of value. For sure. But, and now as you look at that guilt, you know, we talked a little bit about eligibility. You mentioned that. How important is that? You know, you mentioned heat no service, and then maybe, you know, that age or weight that she's first bred. Maybe take a few minutes just to talk a little bit about what are those targets and how important are those targets? If we, you know, if we skirt one of them, or, you know, how impactful is that to that productivity for that animal?
Yeah. So as we, you know, as we've already talked a little bit on age at puberty, but we want to make sure that we're hitting, you know, a good percentage of, I would say, our gilt pool to be able to cycle by 190, 200 days old, right? So obviously, I think a lot of the data suggests anything that cycles prior to 180 days has a greater likelihood to be able to reach parity 3. But I think if we can get a good portion, say 70-80% of a gilt pool to reach puberty by 190 to 200 days of age, that's going to be an ideal target because it sets them up really then to have a heat no service. And then if you project them out another 3 weeks, we're still getting those gilts bred within that 30 to 32 week window, right? And that becomes important just from a standpoint of, I would say, weight management, because obviously a gilt that's 30 weeks old can certainly be pushing the limits from a weight standpoint, especially if they've grown well through the GDU. You know, we don't want to be breeding those gilts too heavy because that can impact just the sheer amount of weight that they have to carry. So from a structure standpoint, it's stressful on their skeleton. But then we also know that those gilts end up being heavier through their productive life and being a heavier maintenance cost. So just to speak on weight then, weight at first breeding, we kind of want to target probably in that 330 to 350 pound weight range is going to be ideal. And then obviously beyond that, a few of the other criterias, if there's any sort of training or acclimation that has to be able to take place, whether you're in a stall barn or if you're in a OPG or a Prop 12 type of facility, making sure those gilts are familiar with the environment they're going to be able to move into. So we're reducing stress on those gilts around that time of breeding. We want to make sure that obviously if you're going to move those gilts into a stall 2 days before you breed, chances are they might go off feed. They might be a little bit more stressy from that standpoint. You might have a weaker heat display from that standpoint, but also, you know, that stress response is potentially going to negatively impact, you know, the reproductive function as well. So we want to make sure, you know, just from a standpoint of having a documented heat no service, having a high percentage of them cycle within 190 to 200 days of, you know, of age for the first time, breeding on that second service, and then having them, you know, an appropriate weight at which we're going to breed them when in that 350 to, you know, 330 to 350 pounds, I think it's going to really set you up ideal from an eligibility standpoint. Now, one that I hear folks talk about, age at first breeding, and I think it's a good one to be able to look back on and make sure, you know, I would say we're meeting the other criteria. But one problem I always struggle with is if you go into a farm and they tell you that, well, I get my best production on my P1s when I breed them at 36, 37 weeks old, right? Which may be true. I mean, if you look back at, you know, obviously when they were bred and you look at their litter performance, sure, there might be a bump from a litter productivity standpoint. But the challenge becomes is how much was that bump really as far as cost-wise, because we had to take an extra several weeks to be able to get them into production, right? So just the non-productive days that gilt accrued offset the, you know, the maybe 2-3 tenths extra pig that she had. So we've got to factor that in. If they're that late maturing and that late to come into a herd from a reproductive standpoint and reach puberty that late, do we really want those gilts to stick around? Because, you know, studies will suggest that they're probably not going to be able to stick around as long as you want them to. And I think it just becomes a challenge because a lot of times those producers, they've got the date at which they came in, the date at which they bred them, and they have the litter data that they got on. So it's a relatively simple, and I would say not a full picture of what we're really seeing in the GDU. So I think it's important from just an age of breeding standpoint, we can use it more like a way to make sure we've got all of our other metrics in line. From as far as if they stood by 190 days, their second heat service will be, you know, 210 days of age. And by that point, they're 30 weeks old and hopefully in that ideal weight range. So I think we can use more, from my perspective, I think we can use more age at breeding as sort of a qualifier to make sure we're doing all the other eligibility pieces correctly, right?
Right. So yeah, I guess what you're saying in summary is just, you know, you want to get that one documented heat, no service, and then get that animal bred as early as possible, and being able to economically pay for, you know, every day you're feeding that animal is costing you money, and if she's not bred, so that can add up. You know, a lot of times you find that that's an area where maybe producers don't really, I guess they understand, but they don't really think about, you know, the cost of those animals sitting around not bred. And so that's an area where it seems like genetics, you know, these animals, and that's another question, they're growing so fast. You know, what do you think is the, you know, I always hear, do we slow them down? But maybe that's not the thing to do. What are your thoughts there? You know, is we get genetics, they're selecting for faster growth. And so our gilts are growing faster. What do you think is the opportunity there? Or what's the data telling us?
Yeah. I think in general, all things in moderation, right? So I think it's obviously going to be important. Obviously, we want the gilts to be able to have grow finish performance, right? We want, you know, at least a little bit of maternal contribution to that terminal animal, right? So it's obviously going to be important from them from a standpoint and from a genetic company standpoint, or if you're somebody who does internal multiplication, you've got maternal barrows that you've got to feed out at the same time anyway, so you don't want them to be ones that lag your system from a growth standpoint. So growth is obviously important. From a gilt standpoint, you know, whether it's including, you know, maybe a little bit of fiber into the diet to maybe make that diet maybe just a little bit more, have a little bit more fill to it, or you know, obviously satiate the guilts a little bit more. So I think there's some things that we can do from a dietary standpoint to maybe just curb that growth, or maybe, you know, I would say maybe not reach their total genetic potential for growth. Obviously, we want them to be able to have that genetic potential, but we want to be able to, you know, manage them from that standpoint. So I know there's been some work that's been done from just a square footage standpoint. Obviously, we want to be able to have, you know, gilts that have ample, you know, in general, probably 12 square feet when we're talking in late finishing, just from a conformation standpoint, allowing those gilts to be comfortable and reduce incidence of lameness and grill finish. As you can expect, when we increase that square footage, we also increase growth because they've got access to the feeder and they've, those gilts are more active in that sense. So there's things we have to be able to counterbalance from that standpoint, from a growth standpoint. But as you talk about it, you know, we want to make sure we're not getting gilts so heavy that we're breeding gilts that are a little bit over-conditioned, as we talked a little bit about it already. But as far as gilts that are going to carry a little bit more weight are going to be predisposed to lameness or conformational concerns. They're going to be heavier really through their productive life. We know that. So from a standpoint of what's it cost to be able to keep that gilt or keep that sow around who's a little bit heavier. And I think there's a pretty good, pretty strong consensus when gilts get bred over 350, 360 pounds, their retention rate falls off pretty dramatically just because of the extra stress I think it puts on their joints from a conformation standpoint. And then just the extra, obviously extra inputs we've got into them to get them that fat, obviously becomes a challenge as well.
So very good. You know, you listed some good points as far as, you know, what are some things that, we check off the boxes for these gilts, and like you said, they got to have space. We want to get them ample space, and they're growing. You know, they're still growing. So we've got to, and then we're trying to get those animals bred. But what do you think are some opportunities? Maybe just on the nutrition side, you mentioned calfos, the minerals, and you mentioned lameness. Or some correlation you think maybe that we should maybe. Implementation of minerals maybe earlier, or what's your thoughts there? I know a lot of people feed those gilts pretty much just, you know, grow finish diets until later stages. What are your thoughts there?
I think in general the a lot of it's going to mirror what we're going to see through grow finish. Obviously we're going to maybe try to buffer the diets a little bit to maybe curb growth, but I know there's been some work that's been done. Even if you try to mitigate or try to, you know, an effort to try to slow growth, you know, maybe lowering the total calories or the density of the diet. So trying to control for metabolizable energy or trying to, account for maybe a little bit lower lysine or varying lysine in the diet. And the thing that's interesting, especially as we look at gilts, you know, just in a GDU, probably have ad libitum feed access. Those gilts will eat to their energy requirements. So even if we try to make a lower dense from an energy standpoint, their average daily feed intake will go up. So it's kind of interesting from that standpoint that the gilt knows how much, she needs to be able to consume just to be able to maintain as well as grow as well. So I think, you know, I think in general, probably just trying to, you know, obviously, as we've stated, maybe inclusion of fiber can maybe reduce their overall intake, but, you know, reduce their caloric intake, but still keep the total diet fill, maybe constant and so forth. And then ultimately, I think maybe probably tailoring a little bit from a lysine standpoint, if we don't want to be able to get those gilts with too much lean deposition as well. So I think there's some things that can be looked at nutritionally there, but I don't know that we've totally zeroed in on what's the best way to slow grow or manage a gilt that has genetic potential for, you know, being fast growing, I guess, if you will.
Right. You know, you hit on, you actually answered my question. I was getting ready to ask, but, you know, you mentioned ad libitum before. When we get these gilts, let's just say now we're at the point we've selected these animals, their structure. You know, maybe we had to have all of them, but maybe let's just say we were able to select those with structure, teat structure, you know, the heat, no service. Now we've got them on our farm. How do we feed those animals? So you're saying we should be feeding those animals as much as they'll eat prior to breeding? Is that a good?
Yeah. So I would say in general, the challenge you have in feeding that gild, obviously, versus that sow is they not only have a energy or, you know, a maintenance requirement, but they still have a requirement for growth, right? Because they haven't finished growing and haven't reached their mature size. So in general, those gilts are going to have to consume a little bit more feed. Now you may, you know, as you get up to that point of breeding or immediately after breeding, you may tailor them back. Obviously, because at that point we're trying to, you know, we want to manage body weight as much as possible. But in general, as we're working through that GDU and getting a heat enough service and so forth, a lot of times, yes, it'll be sort of an ad libitum feed strategy. And then obviously, if there's some sort of a training mechanism in those gilts, you can probably, whether it's getting those gilts, exposed to a free access system or so forth, you know, maybe there's some opportunity to intervene as far as individual feeding standpoints. But in general, it's going to be, I would say ad libbing up to the point when we're trying to get those gilts bred, and then we maybe try to dial back how much we're feeding them.
Very good. So they should be on full feed till they're bred, you're saying, if possible. I mean, I know a lot of facilities, it's kind of a struggle where they house the gilts and what have you, but that'd be the ideal. And so, just thinking now we're kind of at the end here, we've got the animal, on the sow farm, and what are some things that maybe we should be doing differently for gilts than we do for multiparous animals? What are some things that we can do, to help give those gilts, it seems like we're losing, like you said, good point, we lose a lot of them in that second, never make a second parity. What are some things that we can do differently for these animals to help them stay in the herd longer?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing that certainly comes to mind, obviously, is controlling body condition, or even when we talk about, as the industry continues to evolve and adopt more group housing type setups, being able to control for body condition and control for how we group those gilts is going to be important. So, obviously not putting gilts in with more mature sows or ones that are going to be a little bit more hyper aggressive and not only potentially result in injury or lameness in gilts, but also from a standpoint of just being able to create a lower stress environment for those gilts where maybe not as subordinate and still have access to feed and so forth. Those are some things that I think just as far as being able to differentiate those P1s or gilts or P0s and P1s from multiparous sows. I think when you talk about there's some opportunity, I don't know if you really see many farms that do it as far as how can we tailor diets specific to gilts. And I think there's more and more opportunity that we have now with our developing technology from ESF system is how can we, as soon as that gilt enters an ESF, feeder, and we have that ear tag that gets red, what's the opportunity to potentially deliver different diets or blended diets or so forth to a potential gilt? I don't know if there's many farms that are doing that as of yet, but I think there's some opportunity we can do to manage those gilts early on. And then obviously when we get those gilts through to lactation, obviously we want to be able to support those gilts obviously as much as possible. We want to be able to set them up to be able to, be productive moms. And obviously a lot of that mammary development is all occurring in that first lactation. So making sure that we're setting loading those gilts up with as many pigs as she can potentially handle and still successfully, obviously raise. We want to be able to make sure that we're cross fostering and setting those ones up as best we can, just from a future lactation capacity, I guess, if you will.
Very good. I agree 100% on all those points. It's very important. As we know, those gilts are going to eat less than these multi. We've seen these gilts are having multiparous litters. They're not having small litters. So we're asking a lot for an animal, doesn't have the capacity for intake that a multiparous sow. And so to get enough, but they're raising a lot of pigs. But you made a good point too. We want all those teats to be, if a teat's not used, it's not going to be that yield's going to be different. Maybe talk a little bit there. How important is that? You said loading up these gilts. What do you mean are you talking there?
I think just from a, you know, really when I, especially when you talk about guilt development, I think most people even consider it now out through parity one, and how can we set those ones up for future productivity. So just from a standpoint of, you know, if there's parts of the udder that are, undernursed or what have you, or maybe not nursed as aggressively, we're not stimulating just that overall mammary development quite as effectively. And then, you know, maybe capping what that overall milk production and lactation capacity can be for those future litters. And obviously that goes for total milk production, but also we think about what's the capacity for colostrum production as well. And what's the chance that, you know, we can obviously with those litters, you know, in P2 and P3, can we increase the amount of colostrum production, overall milk yield as well? So there's some things that there, I think, especially if you can set those gilts up and get, you know, one pig per one teat and be able to get them, you know, obviously through a successful lactation without depleting their, you know, body reserves too much. We've got, you know, obviously got some opportunity there to be able to make sure we're setting them up for successful lactation in the future.
Agree, 100%. Yep. Yeah, the more we can get that that gilt through that first lactation and the most and come out, you know, in as good a condition, she's obviously going to be well ready for the next parity for sure.
Yeah, I think it goes back to a little bit, you know, we've talked about, again, you talk about lactation, how it relates to the weight at first breeding. You know, obviously we've talked about what's the negative impact of breeding them too heavy, but also breeding them too light. You know, if they don't have enough body reserves to maintain themselves, you know, milk production or energy requirements for lactation will be one of the first things to probably suffer. So obviously we want to make sure we're having gilts at a minimum threshold at weight at breeding, you know, just from the impact of what it could potentially have on lactation performance. So,
yeah, very good point. You know, it's amazing what we're asking these animals to do. And at the point of where we have selected for these, you know, these just hyper prolific litter size. So it's amazing the capacity these animals have to produce milk on a weight basis. So, well, just thinking outside the box on technology, I know you mentioned technology. What do you think are some of the technological areas that are really going to help us down the road? Maybe some that are just on the cusp or, you know, maybe we're not implementing them, but what shows some opportunities, you think?
Oh, I think there's lots of opportunity to be had currently. You know, obviously as we're implementing lots of companies and sow farms and implementing the use of RFIDs, so we can get individual sow data, you know, fairly regularly, and record keeping's, you know, becoming all digitized. So I just think from the standpoint of looking at the data we have currently and trying to figure out how to optimize, obviously, is some low-hanging fruit from that standpoint. But I just think the technology of an RFID is going to be able to help us progress a lot in the future, just from really understanding not only from a overall farm performance, but, you know, trying to isolate individual animals. Okay, like if they, you know, what percentage of the ones that were bred after, you know, hypothetically, presented ones that were bred after 200, what percentage of those actually made it to parity 3? You know, a lot of that stuff is, you know, maybe retrospectively, we've always had to look back at paper records or records that have been, you know, put into online data management software, and you know, how frequent or how accurate some of that gets done becomes a little bit more challenging. So I think, you know, first off, RFID, I think, is one that's obviously is here and present, and one that I think just from a data management standpoint and the sheer amount of data that we're creating is one that we can look at today and I think can help us you know, manage decisions for the future. Another one that I think is interesting, you see a lot more of the, I would say, automated phenotyping, whether it's, you know, a lot of camera activity or whatever to be able to analyze conformation and structure. I think that's one that me personally, I think will be part of the future as far as from a selection standpoint. Now, obviously there's always going to be a human component to it. Obviously we want to be able to, you want to be able to select ones that are going to work best for your farm. But I think as far as taking the subjective component out and be able to assess keeps and calls just with the use of technology that can pinpoint joints and functions and length of stride and how that gelt walks in motion. I think those are all technologies and tools that producers, I would like to think would be able to use in the future. So,
yeah, I that last point, I really am interested to see where that's going to go, because I think, to your point, we don't see now we've got animals, we don't really watch them. We don't know, we'll be able to get algorithms on their gait and how that, correlates to longevity and be able to see that. And also just behavior in general, I think about, it seems maybe these newer animals, they're not as docile as they used to be. I think maybe they've selected some of that. So being able to select those animals, I think that might be an area where we can look at behavior and be able to use that as a selection criteria.
Especially, when we think about what's your sow farm look like 10, 15 years from now? Obviously, there's been, even just in the last 10 years, there's been a transition to group housing or certainly more growth in that area than anywhere else. So how does that, how can we quantify and measure aggressiveness or versus docility or so forth? So, and what's the impact that have on sow longevity and reduced lameness and reduced death loss, right? So I think there's lots of things that we can look at. Obviously, it's going to help us be more efficient and more sustainable in the future, for sure.
Yeah, that mothering characteristic, I think, is huge. And we don't, like you said, we don't really have a way of quantifying that per se, but maybe some of these the camera technology, I think, is going to open up a lot of areas for us to improve, for sure.
Right, right. Well, it's just a way of being able to measure it, right? Like, it's hard to be able to measure docility when it's just subjective caretaker discussion, right? But if there's a way to measure it and quantify it over a length of period of time and how those gilts or sows interact on a daily basis, that's something that, it's maybe a little ways out there, but I think it's something that will be certainly implemented in the future, for sure.
Well, Matt, we're getting close here to the end, but I wanted you to take a minute, just summarize in just a few points. What do you think are the most important things that producers could be doing today to improve their gilt performance?
Yeah, well, I think, like, as we've already discussed, but I think obviously starting that gilt selection probably prior than what you think is ideal is probably best, right? So obviously there's lots of things we can control from an eligibility standpoint, from age of puberty, weight at breeding, number of heat no services. But really trying to be, I think, be critical on what type of gilts we even consider for eligibility. So where does that selection start? How early does it start? When we start stimulating those gilts, obviously you can read conformation and structure earlier in life. So I think there's lots of things that producers can consider when we're looking at that 100 to 150 day window, as far as what type of gilt do I want to even consider for eligibility? And then from that 150, 160 days on, how do we develop those gilts just from a puberty stimulation standpoint, and maybe set those ones up that we deem to be selects at that point? How can we best set them up to be the next reproductive engine of our sow farm is what I think is, I think is valuable from a producer standpoint at this point, for sure.
Well, very good. Well, we've got a lot of golden nuggets today. I've learned things myself, and I think producers can take a lot of these points and go and apply that to your farm. That's always interesting when you can take something and immediately put it in action, and farm. And kudos to, for all the work you're doing. I think this is an area where we, as an industry, we're probably lacking, in understanding gilts, and there's just not been a lot of data, I think, in some areas. So it's an awesome, it's an interesting area where I think there's a lot of opportunity. I agree with you for sure.
I think lots of opportunity. I think even just in the last, maybe 5 to 10 years, I think the opportunity has really been brought to the forefront, right? When we talk about not only survivability, but the turnover rate that we have on sow farms, where it's, and sometimes in excess of 50%, I think we can all agree that probably trying to hone that in a little bit better is obviously going to be better for the industry and more profitable for the producer. So
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think we generate a lot more questions than we have answers. So
just more opportunity for research.
That's right. That's right. Coming on our podcast today, and look forward to catching up with you later.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right.